Many people are discovering that they can't sell their home in this wobbly housing market. Anne Trubeck's one of them, and she's still taking it personally because she loved that house.
It's a beautiful house. It's an 1840s farmhouse. It's out on 2.5 acres of farmland. There's a big barn on it that's on the National Historic Registry. And I did a huge amount of gardening. It's a beautiful spot. So, yes, I think it's an absolutely gorgeous house. And I must say that at times I take it personally that nobody wants to buy it.
But no one is putting in an offer, and Anne has already moved. So when she found herself carrying two mortgages, she had to take in tenants.
When I decided, okay, now I'm just going to try to get rent from this and not try to sell it, the rent didn't come. And I was having to ask them for the rent money every month. And it was horrible because the rent would come in late and I hated having to ask them for the rent and then they would resent me. And I just don't like that.
Looking at the life of a reluctant landlord, I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
In markets all over the U.S., home prices are down. The market's flat. There was a tickle of good news recently when home sales bumped up just a tiny bit, but no one's predicting a turnaround. Not yet. Anne Trubeck lives in Ohio. She decided over a year ago to sell her house and move to a nearby town.
You know, I look back and I really had never once thought, well, maybe it won't sell. I made an offer on a new house and then got all excited to get my other house up for sale and put in a lot of money to spruce it up. Bought lots of flowers for, you know, staging the house. The agent was moving my paintings in just the right place and my furniture and all of that. And
what were the agents telling you? Were they telling you, look, this is going to go first open house?
They weren't saying that, but we priced it in such a way that, yeah, I was really imagining all the great vacations and things I'd be able to buy with my incredible profits.
You were spending the money already.
Absolutely. I'm still spending it.
Tell me about the time when the sign went up, the for sale sign. Were you anticipating phone calls? What was going on then?
You know, it's so long ago, it's hard to remember. But yeah, I think so. And, you know, it's a small town, so, you know, lots of people were asking me, so what's going on? Your house is on the market, or that's, you know, that's a great house. Sometimes cars would slow down on the road, and I would get all excited, and yeah.
Did you have a bunch of people who looked at the house?
There was never a bunch. I did have some people come in and look, though. And we did have the open houses and people came and all of that. But it was really soon. I almost feel like my putting the for sale sign house for sale sign on the curb was the beginning of the slump.
You started this. You're the one responsible. Not Countrywide Financial, not Bear Stearns, but Anne Trubeck started this whole thing. But we still haven't got to the money question. I asked Anne how much she started out asking for her home.
I think my opening price was $275,000, which probably doesn't sound like that much to many people, but in rural Northeast Ohio, that's high.
And how long did it stay on the market at that price?
Oh, I don't know, maybe 6 weeks, and then we went down to, you know, $259,000 and... I don't remember all the ways down.
Was it depressing, though, each time you go down?
Yeah, and then, it kept going down because then at the end of the summer, I decided to take it off the market. And then I eventually put it back on the market. And by the time I took it off the market, I was down to $199,000. And that was 14 months after I originally put it up. And that's almost a year ago now.
And this isn't just Anne's dilemma. Lots of people are having trouble. Some are losing their homes altogether. In Washington, the Senate's stitching together a bill on housing aid, and TV shows like Sell This House peddle words of encouragement for people like Anne who can't sell their home.
Now it's time for a few more last-minute touches. A couple of orchids to contrast the warm tones of the den. Redistribute some of those pillows. Throw in a little color here and there. And add some greenery to brighten up the rooms. Good news, after all that hard work, Arthur and JC sold their house.
You know, they always say, you know, have the vanilla, you know, burning and have the cinnamon rolls in the oven. But, you know, I'm I work, I'm a single mom. I didn't really have the time to get all that done. So I always felt like I wasn't quite. I did pick a lot of flowers and put flowers in, and I, you know, scrubbed the front of the house so it would look nice. But I thought it looked beautiful.
Was there any one moment, Anne, when you thought that you were going to sell it? Someone who was, you know, a prospective buyer talking to you, an agent calling you to say, oh, I think we got an offer. Did you have any of those sort of high points during the time that it was on the market?
No, I never felt like someone might be making an offer. I mean, I had people who came out twice, but I don't think there was ever a moment when I thought these people are going to make an offer. It's just so depressing.
What's really depressing about it, because I've been through this myself, is that you have to keep the darn house so clean all the time because you never know,
right?
Oh,
that's the worst. It's the worst. You know, the strain of having it open and empty, and then I had a caretaker, and then making sure it looked good.
So
when you do feel vulnerable, you feel like they're judging you. You know, they don't want your house.
They don't like your furniture. They don't like the pictures that you have on your walls, right?
Right. They think, you know, your landscaping is, you know, not right.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. At this point, Anne Trubeck is paying two mortgages, knowing she can't go on this way. So she starts to think about renting her place out.
I was really worried about the first winter and it being empty in the winter. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting in a restaurant in Oberlin, a small town, and I was sitting at the bar having breakfast. And this guy next to me was talking to his friend, and he said to his friend, I need to find a place where I can live for free for a couple months while I work on my art and my graphic design. And I said, excuse me, I might have an idea for you. And that's how it happened. And then we made an agreement where he would stay in the house and keep it clean and show it when people wanted to see it. And that worked out. And he continued to stay in the house, eventually paying rent and no longer having to show it for well over a year. And then his friends came in and other people came in. And
This was a trusting move of yours to give your house over to someone, a complete stranger like that?
Yeah, I suppose it was. Well, I mean, it was an empty house, and he was a very short term, you know, first it was just for 2 months at first, and then it worked out.
And he eventually started to pay rent, and then he had friends move in? Is that how you ended up being a landlord to a number of unemployed 20-somethings?
Yeah. Well, they were sort of my friends and his, and I think he knew them, and we made a deal where they would also move in last summer. Yeah.
Was there a moment, Anne, when you realized, ooh, I'm a landlord?
Oh, yeah. When I first started to look forward to getting some real rent, you know, because for a long time I was just getting a sort of a token amount. And so I wasn't really considering that it was going to help me with my finances. When I decided, okay, now I'm just going to try to get rent from this and not try to sell it, the rent didn't come. And I was having to ask them for the rent money every month. And it was horrible because the rent would come in late and I hated having to ask them for the rent and then they would resent me. And I just don't like that position. And that was when I thought, this is really not fun.
How many people were in the house at this time?
Four.
So did you have to chase each one of the four of them for their share of rent?
There was a lot of chasing. Plus, the utilities were still in my name. And so I would pay the utilities, and then they would pay me back. And then by the end, they were all very mad at each other. And a lot of it was about money. And so it was all about, well, I don't owe you the money. So-and-so does. And so-and-so said they'd pay you the money. And there was apparently some illegal subletting that happened at some point. And they're like, well, we shouldn't have to pay because so-and-so were staying here for 3 months without paying anything. I was like, well, I didn't know they were staying there. So, yeah, it got very unpleasant, I will say, at the end. I still like each of them individually, but I just wish I had never been in that role in their lives.
Were you covering your own costs? Or were you?
No. I'm still not covering my own costs. I get rent that is about 100 less than my mortgage. And then on top of that, I need to pay my taxes and my insurance. And my insurance has now doubled because I'm not the primary occupant.
This is like the landlord's policy, right?
That's right, yeah.
Anne Trubeck's drama with her tenants went on for 5 months, and she decided at the end of their lease that she needed to find new tenants, and she did, a family. Now, these new people, she hoped, would make it easier to get the rent, to share the cost of utilities. But the trouble was that Anne was still quarreling with the old tenants.
And there was a lot of back and forth over how much they owed me in propane, because this house is out in the country, so it has a propane tank.
Right.
And it was just, that was when any good feeling between us just went out the window.
How much money are we arguing about here, the propane bill?
Oh, you know, there was a lot of debate. Well, I guess we're really talking about a $500 outstanding amount.
Yeah.
The question was whether they should have to pay it or not, and if it was them, which of them should have to pay it. And it really went back and forth, and I just felt like I can't get out from under this. This won't end.
But this won't end turned out to be something of an understatement. When it came time for the new tenants to move in, all the stuff belonging to the old tenants was still there, still in the house. But the tenants weren't, and they weren't answering their calls or their emails, so Anne had to come over. The new tenants were angry. It's February, the weather is foul. You still want to be a landlord? I'll find out from Anne what happened next in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. It turns out that there are so many people having trouble selling a home that across the U.S., numerous homeowners are becoming reluctant landlords, people who are just trying to get a bit of rent for an empty house. The trouble with that is that many people, and Anne Trubeck in Ohio is one of them, have never been landlords. They don't know the laws and the codes. Let's go back to Anne's story. We pick it up on a cold, wet day, actually February 1st in Oberlin, Ohio. Anne has finally got some respectable tenants for her home, but when they go to move in, they find that the house still has the stuff from the old tenants inside.
I had asked if they could move out earlier and we would forgive them the rent, but they didn't want to do that. And so I said, you know, they're coming in, the cleaners are coming in, so you need everything to be out and leave the keys.
And on the day when they're supposed to be out and the new tenants are moving in? Tell me about that.
Well, I was awoken at 8 in the morning in my house in Shaker Heights by the new tenant freaking out because there was a lot of stuff in the house still. And they had a moving truck with their stuff ready to be unloaded. And so I got my son off to school and then I drove into Oberlin and went into the house. And
what did it look like?
It looked fine, actually, at first. I mean, there was a couch still in the living room, and there was some, you know, a bed and a dresser in one of the bedrooms, and there was a note from the old tenant saying, sorry, we didn't have a chance to clear this out, but we'll call you and let you know when we're going to come get it.
Yeah.
But then when I got there, every drawer, every closet was filled with stuff, the pantry, the fridge, the freezer. So I called the old tenants all morning, but they weren't answering the phones.
So what did you do?
So I started piling the stuff out onto the porch. And when there was too much stuff on the porch, I started putting things onto the curb. And it was a really horrible experience. And, I mean, it was a truly horrible experience. I spent 5 hours doing this. You know, the people moving in were much more ruthless than I. They were like, just, you know, because it was sleeting. It was, you know, 30 degrees. It's
what,
cold
what
here.
What time of year was this?
This was February 1st.
Oh, so there's snow on the ground.
Well, there wasn't snow on the ground at that time, but it was sleeting out. It was wet. It was very wet. And, you know, the new people are like, just throw it on the curb. I'm like, this is their night. These are their files, their work files. I'm not going to put this to get wet. Apparently, I'm supposed to safeguard their possessions for 30 days. So now I'm feeling terrible about the fact that I did this, because apparently a landlord isn't supposed to do that.
I don't know what the rules are. But then, I mean, that's part of this story, right? You're kind of figuring this out on the fly.
I guess so. I mean, it was like half open cereal boxes and meat that, you know, somebody had bought like a quarter of a cow and had the pieces of the beef in the freezer with, you know, the loin written on the outside. I mean, that was just felt terrible to take their food out. And so the new tenant, in fact, the first thing she said to me was when I arrived was, I'd like the locks changed on the doors, because I don't want these people coming back. And so I also had to call a locksmith while this was going on, because, you know, I wasn't going to say no to her. So it just felt terrible. And they did finally show up, and they were angry. And, you know, you know, at some point I said, I tried to keep the stuff, the nice stuff on the porch, you know, and then one of them said, well, that's all his stuff, not my stuff. You put all my stuff on the curb, you know, as if I was being discriminating about, you know, whose stuff was getting the preferential treatment.
And what are we talking about here? And were there computers and like stereos and stuff like that that had to be moved out?
At one point, one of the people moving in said the basement is filled with musical equipment, like really fancy musical equipment, because apparently their band had been practicing in my basement. So I had no idea. And so at some point, you know, this guy drives up and I'm like, can I help you? And he's like, yeah, I'm Joe. I'm here to get the stuff. And they had really very fine knowledge of my house, even though I'd never met those people before, now to get into the basement.
So now you're agreeing that, yes, indeed, the locks should be changed. Right?
Exactly. But, you know, they're nice kids. Nobody's on, you know, they're nice kids.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. A month goes by, and that stuff that belongs to the nice kids, it's still on the curb.
So then all this stuff on the curb was covered in snow, and then it started to hail, and the neighbors are complaining about the eyesore. So finally I called students with a truck and I said, $100, take it to a dumpster. I didn't tell you to do that. Get the stuff off the curb. So finally the stuff was moved. Then the story doesn't end, because they didn't take away everything that I put on the curb. And so that stuff remained on the curb. And then I get an email from somebody saying, not to be a nosy neighbor, but did you know that there's a bunch of stuff piled out in front of your house? You know, and this is when, you know, I just want everything to go away. You know, I just want someone to walk up and say, you know, here's the amount of your mortgage in cash and I'm taking this house. And I'm like, fine, kick out the other people. I've lost tens of thousands of dollars on this sale, but fine, let's just have it all go away.
And it's all your responsibility. Like, this is all up to you, the landlord. Well, right?
Exactly. Who else is going to do it? I said, you know, the right thing to do would be to come and clear off that stuff to the old tenants, but I didn't hear back.
The point of this story is that Anne Trubeck never set out to be a landlord. She wanted to sell her house quick, clean. So all the drama and the emotion of dealing with angry tenants caught Anne off guard.
I was so mad and I was so sad. I was so mad at them for not clearing out, but I was also so sad because it's just, you know, it's just a horrible thing, you know, to do. And it was horrible.
I mean, if you look back on that moment now, Anne, and try to figure out where your sympathies were. Were they with the new tenants, the people who were going to give you money and you know, sort of be your business partners, if you want, for another year? Or were they with the students? You're going, oh, I can't do this. I mean,
I think they were with the students, to be honest, because maybe I, you know, empathize with someone who had kind of screwed up herself with housing or something. I don't know. But I just felt like, yeah, they were trying to move out. You know, they were trying to get it all cleaned out, and they And they didn't do it. But I was also furious, you know, because they had not. I'd been having these horrible emails about money and rent and utilities. But I had never done it the right way. You know, I had never been professional with them. I'd always tried to do it very low key. And so I think if it had been me, I would have been like the new tenants. In fact, when I moved into my new house, I realized this on my way home, when I moved into my new house in Shaker Heights, the day of my moving in day, the old person was still there. The person who had had the house before was still there. And he was getting rid of some stuff. And he's like, hey, do you want this, you know, set of old glasses? And I looked at him like, you got to be kidding me. I've just spent 2 months getting rid of crap so I could move. I don't want your old crap.
I don't want you. I don't want your glasses.
Exactly.
I don't want your dirt.
Exactly. And I was furious that he was there. I felt it was invasive. Mm-hmm. And so I did understand, you know, the new tenant's perspective completely. I just didn't want to be the person who was in the middle of it all. But of course, I got myself into the situation. So.
And what were the young kids saying? The students, the unemployed? I mean, had you become this evil slumlord to them?
Oh, I think so. I think I had the one person who got really furious at me said she just could not stand the way that I treated her and them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had never once in those 6 months paid me on time. And they had never once paid me until after I had asked them twice. And so, you know, I don't know. Maybe I didn't do it right, but they weren't good tenants either.
I was reading a newspaper story a couple of days ago about some town, and I guess this is happening in places across the country, where, you know, the town council, the city council is now passing laws saying if you want to rent your house, you have to, you know, take on these responsibilities. In a way saying, you know, we don't want a whole bunch of amateur landlords getting caught between tenants in the way that you did. What do you think?
That's interesting. You know, I don't know. I know that the relief that I felt at no longer having that empty house on the market, now I feel a different kind of strain of, I don't really know what I'm doing, being a landlord. It was a really horrible experience that happened. And now I'm nervous about it. I don't know. But, you know, what choice do I have then? You know, I can't sell the place. Now, if you're saying I can't rent the place, you're over a barrel. I went to the bank when the interest rates went down. Yeah. And I thought, you know what? Maybe I'll refinance. And they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't let me refinance because the house is not owner-occupied. And they wouldn't do it. And I don't really believe this, but sometimes I hear about these people who are foreclosing and got these huge mortgages that they couldn't afford and these, you know, loans that didn't make sense. And I'm making my mortgage payment every month, and I'm not going into foreclosure, but I am, you know, not getting any help. And I am really, you know, over a barrel financially because of the situation.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. I asked Ann Trubeck how she's thinking now about her new role as a landlord.
As long as nothing goes wrong. But something will go wrong, and I need to, you know, be able to take care of it when it does. And, you know, spring's coming, and there's a lot of weeds that are going to grow out that I need to take care of, and I wish that I didn't, and I wish it was all going away.
Now you're living now, what, 40, 50 miles away from that old house?
Right.
And what happens if the tenant calls up and says, tap's dripping, toilet's blocked?
Yeah.
No, it's a serious question. What do you do?
Yeah. What do I do? Well, you know, what I've said to them, and they've done this on one occasion already, is like, you know, the best thing is if you take care of it and leave me the bill and I'll pay the bill. And I'm fine with that. If they're fine with that, I feel lucky. But if they're not, then I'll need to call the plumber and have the plumber go out there. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the tap doesn't work in my house. That I'm living in now. But I'm not calling anyone to fix it. I really want a landlord. I want a landlord so badly. I lie in bed. I think, gosh, I wish there was just someone I could call who would just come over and take care of these things. Homeownership, I think, is overrated in a lot of ways.
Have you really changed your mind about this, about homeownership?
I think for me, yeah. you know, I tried at a certain point in my life to be somebody who would learn how to fix this or that thing and be handy. And I just, there's too many other things in, that I feel like I have to take care of and need to take care of. And
yeah.
I think I would be fine with, you know, throwing my money away each month, as they call it, in exchange for having a landlord who would come and fix things. Yes, I do wish that when I had rented in the new place I'm at now rather than bought. And I certainly have yet to see that that real estate leads to financial good things. Yet to see. I've got 2 houses yet, and so far I've had nothing but, you know, negative balance on them.
But it's not just about figuring out how to plug in a cordless drill or knowing what a plumber's wrench looks like. I mean, a lot of it has to do with the response, because you can, as you point out, you can hire someone who will do that for you if it really comes down to that. A lot of it has to do with the responsibility, the obligations that you have as a landlord. I guess I'm curious to hear it from you, who, I mean, you're kind of thrust, not necessarily, well, unwillingly, I guess is a good way of putting it, but you're thrust into this situation of being a landlord against your will. Has it really been awful?
Well, it hasn't been awful. I mean, that experience of getting the old tenants out and the new tenants in was wretched and very emotionally draining for me. And, uh-huh. and in fact, you know, I got home that day. I could not stop thinking about what a horrible experience it was. But yesterday, today, last week, I had nothing that I needed to do to keep that house going. And tomorrow I'll probably get a check for, mm-hmm. you know, close to my mortgage. And that's not bad.
I mean, I guess I'm asking on behalf of all those people who are in similar situations, who are thinking to themselves, hey, I can't sell it. I'll just rent it.
Yeah. I mean, if you can find... I mean, I will say, you know, right now, if I had the chance to do it again, I would lower the price of the house another $20,000.
Oh, when it was on the market.
Like, if I didn't have these people in here for a year, I might just put it up this spring and just slash the... Because now they're saying this market's not going to turn around for a long time, which means I'm going to be stuck in this position for a long time. And I'm still running at a loss.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I made this decision in September to rent, you know, through February 2009. And if I were making the decision right now, you know, do I put it back on the market or do I rent it? I think I would put it back on the market and I would make it a fire sale and someone else would take the house and I would just be able to finally walk away.
So what's your version of the American dream now? Paying the landlord the rent?
Paying the landlord the rent, absolutely. A nice condo maybe would be as far as I'd go with a maintenance fee.
But home ownership, no thanks.
No thanks, but there are some people, I mean, I see some people, I think, boy, you're fools not to buy this house. And there are such great bargains out there. I see these for sale signs and I think, I should buy that house. It's like, it's bargain basement prices. It'd be a fool not to buy it.
You can't let go of this.
I know, I don't buy them, but I do. And I tell my friends, you should buy this house.
In fact, there's this 1840s farmhouse.
Let's say that one more time. Outside of beautiful Overland, Ohio, for sale. It's beautiful. You can see the axe marks on the beams, hand-hewn beams, original pine flooring.
There's even a few empty cardboard boxes on the curb.
You got it.
Ann, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much.
Ann Trubeck lives now in Shaker Heights, Ohio. Now, in exchange for Ann's story, we have a picture of her 1840s farmhouse in Overland. the one that's still for sale, you can look at it. It's on our website, thestory.org. Did I say it was still for sale? Don't be surprised. Now, in just a moment, I'm going to join Jeff Weinstock on a trip back to his ancestral home. Jeff's family came from Latvia, and his trip back into the branches of that family tree take him, well, deep into a forest that he thought didn't exist, in a town he couldn't find on a map. That's next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Ask anyone who's taken a trip back to an ancestral home, and chances are it's a journey that most people will tell you never quite turns out the way you might imagine. When Jeff Weinstock was a kid, he'd never done much thinking about his family roots in a place called Latvia. It was more like some spot on a storybook. That was until his grandfather went back and brought some photos home.
I remember him sitting me down when he came back from this trip and showing me the pictures of, he said, this is my country, this is where I'm from, and these are my cousins. And they were beautiful pictures, sort of 1960s colors, sort of technicolor pictures, bright, bright colors, of these strangers embracing my grandfather and dressed in kind of different clothing than we were used to in the United States. And I remember as a little boy, I was about 8 or 9, trying to figure out what that meant, that these were cousins who didn't really make sense to me.
Did you connect the fact that this was the land that your own ancestors had come from, that you were somehow connected to Latvia at that time, or was it just, you know, like another planet to you?
I think a little bit of both. I think that growing up, kids ask, where are we from? And especially as a child or grandchild of immigrants, you ask your family, where are we from? I think that I always knew the answer, like I knew an answer to a question, that the answer was we were from Latvia on my mother's side.
Did your mother not talk much about Latvia or sort of enhance your connection to that country?
I think their number one job was to become an American. And I think that they were very focused on becoming American in the deepest, most profound way possible. And life probably wasn't very pretty back there. And certainly struggling to find a way in the new world. There wasn't this glorious past that we were reminiscing about.
Jeff Weinstock's ancestral home is actually a small village in Latvia called Bikava. His grandfather often expressed his attachment to the place, but as Jeff was saying, his mother did not. Except one time that Jeff remembers. It was the day he was accepted into college.
I had my heart set on going to Yale University. And the day I got accepted, I ran home and left a note for my parents to tell them. And they weren't home, and I went back to school. And at the end of the day when I went home, my mother was standing at the door, and she opened the door and she said, it's a long way from Bikava to Yale. And I thought, yeah, in 2 generations to have come so far from a tiny little, we call them a shtetl in Yiddish, a little town, a little hamlet, to have come from there to a famous university like Yale, that's a huge, huge step.
Jeff says he didn't make that step back into his own past until years later, when he was in Israel. His cousin lived there and was working on a family tree.
Certainly my curiosity grew. I was surrounded by the issue of roots. I was surrounded by the issue of the Holocaust. I was surrounded by older people who bore the scars and the wounds of the war still. And eventually I did a very, very big research project on the genealogy of my father's side of the family in Slovakia and Hungary, and was very, very successful and found an enormous treasure trove of documents and went there and found some relatives and found the little town where my father was from. And several years later, I said, okay, now it's time to do this for mom's family.
What did your mother think about it? I mean, if she hadn't made a big deal about being a child of Latvia or a descendant of Latvians, what did she think when you said to her, I think I'm going back?
I think she was a little bemused. I think she was puzzled. I think she thought, why would you want to go there? She's not a big traveler, not a big fan of travel. But I think she was very touched at the interest that I took in her side of the family. She always had a very, I think in her heart, she had and still has a sentimental connection to this place, and the feeling is, in some way, we are still from there. We are from there. The place belongs to us in some way. I was on the plane, and I remember thinking, I'm going to Latvia, but it's like going to the moon. I knew it was real because I was on the plane, and I had a hotel confirmation in my bag, and I had a rent-a-car receipt. I was going to rent a car and drive to the little town where my grandfather came, Bykova. And I had a guide who was going to help me, and I had all of these palpable, tangible artifacts with me that proved that this is a real place. But I still couldn't believe that Latvia had not frozen in 1923 when my grandfather left.
You probably had friends in Miami who were also saying, where exactly are you going to?
That's right. Some people said, do you mean Lithuania? And I said, that's close. That's actually right next door.
That's good.
Many people had no idea. Many people had no idea where it was. And I pointed it out on a map and I explained that I came from there in many ways. You know, I always think that every family has stories or has legends. And some of them are true and some of them are not true. And some of them have been told so many times that they become true in the family's minds. And our legend, our myth, was that my grandfather Ben was born in Bykova. And more specifically, in Bykova Wald. Bykova Wald would be in Yiddish or in German, the forest of Bykova. And I looked on maps and I pored over atlases and even with a magnifying glass trying to find it, I couldn't find it. And then with the advent of the internet, I started searching and searching and I just couldn't find it. There is no such place. And my cousin, who'd done the family tree, sent me the tree, and it says, no, your grandfather was born in a town called Vilani. And that I could find. It's a small town, but I could find it easily on the map. And I said, well, first I told my mom, I said, you know, I think your dad was born in Vilani. She says, no, he's from Bykova. It's this part of our knowledge about the family. He's in from Bykova Wald. Mm-hmm. And I finally, through a very, very strange and wonderful Google search, I found the Birdwatchers Society of Bykova.
But you couldn't find the place on the map.
That's right. And what they said was the place is now called a completely different name. It's called Gaigalava. And someone had written in his blog or his entry on the internet, I belong to the Gaigalava Birdwatcher Society, previously known as Bykova. And I said, Eureka, now I know where it is.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. It was about 5 years ago when Jeff actually made his first trip back to Latvia.
I remember when I arrived in Latvia, it was about a 20-hour trip with layovers, a very long trip. And I was standing in line at passport control, and I saw a Latvian soldier who was checking the passports. And I thought, well, okay, I should either – he's going to say, welcome to Latvia, and I'll either, you know, bend down and kiss the ground, or I'll sing a Latvian folk song. But I didn't bend down and kiss the ground because it's embarrassing and silly. And I don't know any Latvian folk songs, so I just kind
thing.
Of – yeah, I just said thank you, and I shuffled off and got my baggage. But driving in the car, and we had a very well-planned-out route we were going to take to the different towns where the Marchevsky, later known as Morris, by the way, that was their name in the U.S., where the Marchevsky family was from, all the different towns, I was very, very excited, and I started to think, this is a monumental journey. It's 80 years, almost to the day, and I am tracing the steps backwards that my grandfather took when he was leaving for a new life. And actually, thinking about it, thank goodness that he did. I mean, Latvia is the country that lost the highest percentage of its Jewish population in World War II. 90% of Latvian Jews were killed. Not the largest in number, but the largest in percentage.
Yeah.
And I think without a doubt, I would not be sitting here today if my grandfather had not left.
Jeff Weinstock had managed to make email contact before he left with the assistant headmistress at the school in Bykova. So now he's with a guide, and that's where he's headed.
I remember an incredible thing happened the very first day in Latvia. I was in Riga, in the capital, and just marveling at the beauty of it, and couldn't believe it. I kept saying to myself, I'm in Latvia, I'm in Latvia, and getting goosebumps when I said it. And I sat down to have lunch at a cafe, and I ordered something, and the waitress said to me, in impeccable English, she said, tell me, where are you from? And I said, I'm from the United States. And she said, oh, so you've come a very long way. And I said, yes, but my grandfather was from here. And she thought for a moment. She was silent for a moment, and she said, so you have a little piece of Latvia inside of you. And I thought, that's it. She just summed it up right there. That's exactly what it was about.
So what was it like visiting Bykova?
I had studied the map and almost memorized the map. So the towns which were being announced on the road signs were almost like old friends that were greeting me. And I just remember this enormous palpable excitement growing in my chest as we got closer and closer. And it would say, Villani 70 kilometers, Villani 40 kilometers, etc. And finally, we got to Villani, which was my grandfather's birthplace, if not where he grew up. And I remember standing there and two things happened. I thought, first of all, I'm not sure I want to go in because this is this place that's mythical, that's monumental, that has loomed in my imagination and my family's imagination for 80 years since my grandfather left.
So what are you thinking? It's better left as a myth than actually explored?
Exactly. Some things are better left untouched. It could be very disappointing. It could be terribly ugly. The people could be unpleasant. Or it could be just nothing. It could be just bland. And I didn't want it to be bland either. I wanted it to mean something. So we went in and we found the school. I had an appointment. I had called the teacher. She had a cell phone, which I thought was amazing, in this little town.
This was the assistant headmistress you've been corresponding with?
Assistant headmistress and the English teacher standing by her side, who apparently had been translating her letter, her emails to me. And they greeted me. They came running out of the school to greet me, and we met, and she showed me around the town. And I finally said to her, her name was Anastasia, the English teacher, and I said, I need to ask you a question, though. My grandfather referred to it as Bikova Wald, which means the forest, Bikova Forest. And she said, well, we have a forest here. And I said, can we go? And she said, absolutely. So we drove in, and I said, you know, the family had a turpentine business. And she said, I know what you're talking about. And she took me to a place in the forest with some felled trees, and she said, this is where they used to make turpentine. And I was numb, and I thought, this is the place. This is where my grandfather played. This is where he fought with his brothers. This is where his parents yelled at him. This is where he decided to leave and to save himself and save me in the future and all of my family. And I started to cry. And then she did something very beautiful. She turned away and she pointed to some flowers, some little white flowers on the ground, very little dainty flowers. And she said, those are mayflowers. They're very typical of this region of Latvia. I said, oh, they're very pretty. And she said, I have to tell you something. It's forbidden to pick them by law. They're a protected flora species. And she bent down and she picked me a little bouquet of Latvian mayflowers. And in that way, she connected me to my place. And the last thing I did before I left the forest was I bent down and I picked up a rock. And I brought a little piece of it back with me. I have it in my pocket right now. And that is the proof that there is such a place, and it did exist, and it still exists. And I was there.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. There was one more place that Jeff Weinstock wanted to visit, though. Many of his family members had fled east to Kyrgyzstan, but his great-great-grandmother, her name was Bluma, well, she was over 80 years old in 1941, and she was too ill to travel when the Nazis came.
The end of 1941, the Nazi soldiers evacuated all the Jewish apartments and took the Jews to the ghetto. Bluma, according to what the family told me when I was there, Bluma was carried down the stairs. And when she couldn't walk, she was shot on the steps of her house. Mm. And the very last day I was in Latvia, I told a woman who I'd met who was showing me around that I wanted to find these addresses. I'd found in the municipal archives, the national archives, excuse me, I'd found a treasure trove of documents. I found my grandfather's original ID card, and I held it in my hand. It had his picture. I'm looking at a copy of it right now as I speak with you. I'd found Bluma's original identity card, which somehow was preserved after the war and confiscated, and it's in the archive. And I held, with her picture, the actual document that she held in her hand, my great-great-grandmother. And I had the address as a result. It gave a street name and a street number and an apartment number. And I said to this woman, I said, I'd like to go to that address. And she said, well, you know, during the war, after the war, the Soviet times, things changed a lot, so I don't know if the house still exists. We don't think it exists anymore. I said, well, let's try. And we went to the street. It's a main street. It's called Lachplesha. Main thoroughfare, number 77/79, apartment 1. And we went to the street, and we looked and we looked, and we found the house. And I turned to her and I said, is this it? And she said, look, I can't guarantee that they didn't renumber the houses, but it looks like it is. And I stood at the entryway of the house. There were apartments up in the top three or four floors, and there's a hardware store on the entry floor. And there were stairs, four or five stairs that one would walk out of to get down to the street, just as they described in this terrible story. And I realized I'm standing at the place, which is most likely this the very spot where my great-great-grandmother was shot and killed. And so what's customary in the Jewish tradition at a gravesite, and indeed this was in a way her grave, is you read from the Book of Psalms. So I put on my kippah, my yarmulke, and I started to pray, and I realized that foolishly I'd forgotten my prayer book in the hotel. I didn't have one with me. And so by chance, I just picked a psalm that I know by heart. And it's a psalm that is read every night before you go to sleep. Happy is he who fears God. And the last verse of the psalm has the following words, Ure'e banim levanecha, may you see your children's children. And when I got to those words, may you see your children's children, I froze. And I thought, my gosh, I am the child's children. I am the child of the child of the child of the child standing here and standing here where my great-great-grandmother was killed and completing her circle. And the enormity of the symbolism really floored me.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Jeff Weinstock says he reached down once again, found a small stone, and he left it by the door at the stair where his great-great-grandmother Bluma is thought to have died.
You know, I always wondered in our tradition if the stone is, what does it mean? Is it, you're saying I was here, but are you saying that to the living who'll come and visit the gravesite and they'll know that other relatives mm-hmm. were there? Are you saying it to the dead? Here I am, I haven't forgotten you. And I thought in many ways I was saying it to both. We are here. I'm here. My family is still here. The Jewish people was not extinguished, was not exterminated. We are still alive. And please note that we're still here at this very spot.
Have you thought at all about how these trips back to Latvia have changed you or affected you?
I think before this trip, I knew my immediate family. I knew my parents, my grandparents, my uncles and aunts and cousins. But beyond that, it was this amorphous, shapeless, nameless, blank history. Names floated around, but I couldn't put it in any context, and I didn't know any further back than the generation that came to the U.S. And by going there and finding the documents about many, many generations and seeing the places and seeing the house and seeing the synagogue and seeing the ruins of the Jewish community and meeting the relatives who are still alive and still there, I felt like I found my place in the context, in the historical context. So I was no more an orphan in history. I had found the history that I belonged to.
Jeff Weinstock wrote to me with his story. You can do the same thing. The fastest way to find me is through our website. Just send a note to me at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.